give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Massey and Paul. This is episode 4 of season 2. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back from the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. The show does contain film spoilers, so if you have not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first. It might help you understand a little bit better. And now for today's show, I hope you enjoy. No, I'm delighted to say today we are joined by Dr. Stephen Behan, who is going to join us as we discuss Friday Night Lights. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, Colm, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Very good. And welcome, Paul and Massey, as always.
Hello, Colm. How are you getting on?
Good.
Well,
hello, Dr. Stephen. How are you getting on?
Good, Massey. Thanks a million for the invite.
No worries. No, just you sit back and relax tonight, okay? You don't have your dictator over your shoulder. Sorry, director over your shoulder telling you what to do. So just relax.
As a shot across the bow straight away there, Massey. Okay. I thought we were coming on for a friendly chat, but fair enough.
I tell you, just you can say what you like on this show.
And whatever whatever we don't like gets edited out. But anyway, here, what do you think of the film, Mr. Behan?
I really liked the film. Really enjoyed it. When Paul asked me to come on, I was happy enough with the movie choice. I remember the first time I saw this movie, I was actually coaching a team at the time. We were traveling down. It was a college hurling team, and we were traveling down to Galway to play in the finals weekend. And one of the lads put this on. You know the way the buses back then had a like video or DVD player or whatever it was. And one of the lads put it on, and we watched it on the bus on the way down. And we went out and won the semi-final, and there's loads of clear eyes and all that malarkey being shouted afterwards. And then the final, we went out and lost. And the player who put that DVD on was getting an awful time of it that set us off on a losing streak for the weekend. So that was how I got introduced to the movie.
It brings back a lot of memories, so, and a lot of similarities to film for you, so.
What do you mean by that, Massey?
You won the semi-final and lost the final.
Oh, yeah, fair.
Massey and Paul, did you enjoy it?
It was a good film, not a great film.
Yeah, look, a couple of minutes into the film, it started promoting Nikes instead of Adidas, and there was immediately against the whole premise of the film at that stage, you know, when Bobby Miles is all about is Nikes rather than Adidas, and then it was a pair of Adidas boots defaced in it as well, and didn't sit well with me.
I suppose, look, from the start, we go straight into it, and the Permian Panthers are the team based in Odessa, Texas, and I suppose from the get-go, we kind of see the seriousness of it, where there's camera crews at the training session and stuff like that. But one thing that comes out very, very early is the parental pressure and how an overbearing father can put an awful lot of pressure on a son. And I suppose it's something we'd see an awful lot in not just in the GA, but in all sports, like, wouldn't we?
It's really interesting. The first time you see that in the movie, actually, it happens on the pitch. So, like, obviously, these guys are mad into their football down there in Odessa. But the father actually comes onto the training pitch, first day of training camp, and he basically ridicules his son in front of the whole team, the rest of the, like, there was a huge amount of a crowd actually even watching the training. And I thought it was really telling that the coach actually did nothing. He just stood there and observed it. So from the start, you're thinking, well, what is this coach actually, where's his priorities at? Or what's he letting this parent do to one of his players without intervening? Certainly, like, you would like to think that if it happened on a training pitch that you were involved in, that a parent came on and started ridiculing one of their players, that you would, even if it was their own child, that you would intervene to, at the very least, move it off the pitch, you know?
Yeah, I'd 100% agree with that. Like, that really stuck out to me, that Gary Gaines is extremely meek in that situation, and he didn't look to engage in any manner. Like, even if he turned his back and completely walked away from it, okay, that's a decision made, but he done nothing, and he didn't. Like, I thought it was a weak personality trait, which, like, he didn't impose himself then throughout the rest of the film as well, you know? And, like, agreeing with Stephen, if that happened in a session I was involved in, I would intervene. I don't know how I'd intervene, But there would be an intervention there, definitely.
As a coach, you have a duty of care to your players. Mm. And like legally, I'm sure there's something there as well. If you see something like that happening, you have to report it. It wasn't a nice thing at all. And hopefully it never happens to any of us that something come across like that on a pitch, because it's just a difficult situation.
Like, again, though, like, he's obviously a massively volatile character, the father. And maybe Gary Gaines was aware that he could react negatively. Like, you just need to have a look at the scene where his young lad brings home Maria or Melissa or whatever. He started with him anyway. And his carry on there when the son came home, you know, like it was poor. So maybe Coach Gaines is just avoiding
conflict,
massive conflict. Yeah, you know what? Maybe he expected it to explode.
Yeah, I think there's other instances in the movie where you see him avoid conflict as well, though, or avoid confrontation. So you see when the are they called the boosters? Is that what they're called? The parents who are bankrolling the whole thing, or the local businessmen, and they pop into him before the game to talk about defense strategy, and he just lets them come in and they sit there and he just sits and listens to it. And I get it. I suppose the situation was that it was like he's very highly paid and gets more money than the principal and stuff like that, and there's a lot of pressure on it. But even still, you would think that you might take maybe a couple of minutes of it, but you'd politely then try and move people on, or actually just tell them to get lost. You're preparing for a game, you know. Surely he had other priorities at that stage of the game or the day.
Yeah, there is meal ticket though. So I'd say he was just trying to keep everybody sweet, really. Like, it was a very high pressurized job for a school coach, like getting, like he was on, like I said, bigger salary than the principal. He's like scrutinized 24/7. Like, there's radio shows, incompetent about every decision he makes. Like, it's crazy to think like that's about school's football. It's like nearly as bad as the Hartley Cup, like, really, isn't it?
Nearly. I'd say it could be as bad, Massey.
Jeez, I wouldn't say it's on that level at all, to be honest with you.
Well, apart from the phone-in shows, but like you've got nearly everything else. You know, it's high pressure.
Sorry.
Is that clear about town?
Sorry, lads. What's the Hartley Cup?
Sorry, Stephen. It's a hurling competition in Munster. Maybe you might be unaware of it, but it holds a lot of prestige in Munster schools, I suppose.
It's typically the team Ciarán's beat on the way to the All Ireland.
Okay.
In the Hearty Cup, Ciarán's typically beat them a couple of weeks later.
That's usually about right.
But like that thing about them getting paid 60k a year or 60k. Like in 1988, the majority of the highest paid positions in schools and colleges in America is, be it the football or the basketball coach or the person who's in charge of that high level sport in that particular school. You know, it might be the athletics program, but they are paid and viewed as more important than the academic people in a lot of them institutions, you know.
Well, they're seen as the meal ticket then again for the athletes, especially athletes from poorer backgrounds. They have to provide them with the opportunity to better their futures and better their lives. But getting back there to the training session at the start there, how do you feel about, say, like they're about, what age, 17, 18 years of age?
Mm-hmm.
Like having parents there watching them, TV crews there watching them, whatever it is. Like when we were talking about coaching here in Ireland, like, what would you do with parents interfering like that?
Like, when you say parents interfering, the parents are driving them to the sessions. They wouldn't be there without their parents, Mossy.
Yeah, but I'm talking about talking to the coaches, telling them what they should be doing, this or that, or my Johnny should be playing, or he should give him a chance in the forwards. How do you deal with stuff like that?
Yeah, that is a different scenario.
I think there's a couple of different angles that comes through in the movie as well. You see, like we spoke around the sort of the father-son relationship with your man the first time, in terms of coming out and taping the ball to his hands and ridiculing him on the pitch. But on the other side of that, then you look at Booby's uncle, and he's the opposite. Like, he is telling them he's going to be the next big thing. He's building him up for this high-flying NFL lifestyle and building him up for this. You're going to be rich. You're going to get out of Texas, etc. And maybe setting unrealistic expectations, or certainly Ruby looked like he was the business on the pitch, but you would like to think that the uncle would be the one who would have to potentially keep his feet on the ground and keep him grounded, make sure he gets an education, make sure he gets into a good college with a good degree, etc. From a coach's point of view, that's a hugely complex dynamic there. On one end, he has one parent gone ballistic at his son on the pitch, and on the other end, he has a guardian who is basically bypassing the coach, going talking to scouts, etc., all on his own. So I don't know. Like, it's a difficult dynamic to manage, I would imagine, particularly across 30, 40 athletes or whatever it may be.
Yeah, and I suppose, like, and also something we spoke about in season one, but about how you can let the sport define you. And like Booby was a classic example of that. He was a football player, and he said it himself, "I'm nothing else without it." And like, without going back over old ground, like, it is something that I suppose the COVID has brought to light, that there's more to life than playing hurling or playing football, be it as an intercounty player or a club player, that there is more to life than just the game. And I suppose the game can pick you up and spit you out as fast as anything else as well.
What did you think of his approach to those relationships that we saw in the movie? So, like, you could see he didn't intervene in that first training day, but then later on, not too long after that in the movie, you see he's over having dinner with Booby and his uncle, or he has them over for dinner, and they're talking about having a great season and blah, 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 blah. Whereas he doesn't even know the name or know some of the other players that are on the team. So that sort of favoritism and how that potentially impacts on the rest of the group.
It was similar to Any Given Sunday, wasn't it? In terms of Willie Beaman, not coach, not knowing his name. No, American football panel. So what was in this panel there? Maybe 50, 60 players.
Yeah.
He was probably getting to know. Trying to get to know his star players and trying to keep them happy. And especially the personality that Booby had, probably just trying to pacify him. But as a coach, you should try to know all the members of your panel, get to know their first names. Like, when you're coaching down at a nursery or under 10 level, like, you'll have so many different kids playing. It's vital they go home thinking that you know their name. Like I said before, like, a tip I have is that if I hear a child calling someone else's name, say Stephen is saying, or pass the ball there, Cullum, I'll always say, good pass, Cullum, or whatever. I'll re-emphasize that name there in my head so I get to know it. But I think names are very, very important to children. And as a coach, you have to get to know them.
I suppose it was an interesting dynamic as regards, like, even when Booby was injured and he asked him, he said, you should go to Midland for a scan. And they were like, no, look, we'll be okay. We'll be good next week. And then when he eventually went for the scan and he came back and he said, look, I'm good to go. And the coach knew he wasn't good to go, yet he still put him in the position where he got the injury. And I don't know, was it out of weakness of will from the support and the people on the sideline who were kind of forcing the issue that he wasn't able to stand up to that and go, look, I know he's not right. And I think as coaches, a lot of time we'd know when players aren't right. But I suppose back in those days, it was a case of get to pound the flesh out of him. If Booby can come on here and get us over the line, even if it injures him again the next day, is it worth doing? And I suppose as coaches, we're much more conscious now of the player welfare behind things like that, wouldn't we?
What about the Henry Shefflin incident in the All-Ireland final, where he had done his cruciate and still played and didn't last long in the game?
He's a grown adult, though, to make that decision, where Booby was a teenager who had his career ahead of him.
Like, if Booby had got, let's say, a medical thing straight away and was able to get an operation on it or whatever, like, you know, the chances are he could be back within 12 months, especially with an ACL. Now we know that recovery, no, obviously it's a bit more high tech these days than it was, but there was chance, you know, if he was properly advised, as opposed to the coach looking at this season. And he was under that pressure. He was told by the boosters and by the I suppose his employers that it's all or nothing. If you don't win, find a new place to live.
So, yeah. But if you go back to the very start, at the time how he got injured first, like, there were 44-6 up or something.
Yeah,
the star player was taken out of the game and the substitute wasn't ready. Like, he wasn't ready. Players should be ready, right? So get that in. But like, if you're winning a match by that much, like, at any level, it is an opportunity to try your other players, give them a game, give them plenty of game time. Like, was there any reason for him to go back into the game at that stage,
other than your man Coleman forgetting his helmet?
Except, yeah, like, is there any other, like, could he have used another players? giving more game time to someone else, whatever it was. Like, what would you do in that situation? You're winning a match well, even a championship match. You're up by 15, 20 points, 10 minutes to go. What? Doesn't have to be challenging. I'm talking about under 12, under 14 level, whatever it is.
There's always a risk, we'll say, taking a player off and putting them back on, and they're more exposed to the potential of getting injured at that stage, you know? So it is something that you need to be careful of in doing that, you know? And I just think that element of, we'll say, someone gets injured on the pitch or something happens on the pitch and you have to get a person in really quick. You're making a decision in a split second, and in making that decision that you hadn't planned, you hadn't anticipated, can often work against you, which it obviously did in this scenario, you know. So we'll say in as a coach in trying to plan for these things, I think you prepare for worst case scenario as often as you possibly can as a coach or manager.
What do you think about reintroducing a sub? I know it's different in American football from Villain. What about reintroducing a sub who you've taken off already in as another sub rather than the rest of your panel members?
So he was taken off and he's coming back as a sub, or you're saying
you took him off. You're a player, you're taken off, and say you're taken off after maybe what? Half time or into second half, but then you're reintroduced later on in the match. I'm not talking like a Peter Canavan tactical whatever. I'm talking about a player just say you don't trust the rest of your bench, your rest of your squad. What does that say to the substitute?
The fella McLaughney who came on, who scored a winning goal for Killadangan, he had started the game, was taken off and came back on. Like, that happens. Like,
yeah, but that's at adult level. I'm talking about, say, underage.
I don't think there's a hard and fast rule on it. I think if it's fully around development, then you're looking to try and use the full panel. If it's about winning a game, you need to do whatever it takes to win the game, you know?
Yeah.
I think it depends on the age group as well. Like, if you're dealing with 8, 9, 10-year-olds, like, you would ideally love to be having rolling subs, so lads going on and off different positions, give everyone a chance being in goal and in the forwards and the backs, etc. Because purely there, you're just trying to keep get lads involved, get them interested in playing, get them to get that sort of love of the game that you'd hope that they would have. And as they start getting older then, and it gets a little bit more competitive, people start finding their positions or positions where they would, that they're maybe more suited to or they prefer playing. But you still, like, I remember coaching a team from under 13 to 16 not that long ago, and like, we did our best to play everyone for at very least for half a game. Okay. And sometimes that was easy. We were either winning well or we were getting hammered. But other days, you're 2 or 3 points up and you're in that scenario where you're like, Jesus, now if I keep these lads on here, we'll probably win the game. And you're weighing up in your head, well, will a win do the young lads a bit more, do a bit more good for the group, for the greater good, if that makes sense. But a lot of the time you go back to, well, Jesus, if I was 13 or 14 and I didn't get a game, I've gone home on a Saturday, I'd be fairly down or annoyed about it or pissed off. So we tended to play the players. Your point, Massey, about bringing someone, taking someone off and putting them back on at kids' level, it's if there's someone who hasn't gone on yet at kids' level, that's a very, very stark message. I think you'd be sending them to them that you didn't rate them or you didn't trust them, you know.
Yeah, big time.
I think it probably goes back to the discussion of when do you need to start taking things serious? Like, when do you take the kids' gloves off, I suppose, and say, we're putting on our best team, we're trying to win this game. And what age, and each club and each coach will have their own idea of when that is, be it under 18, be it under 16. Our club might have a plan, but I suppose that'll link in with that, I'd like to think. I suppose the other thing, and that as well with Booby's injury, like, is you can see how, like, I presume as coaches now, you can all look back on some match that has gone wrong or some season has gone wrong and how it hinges on one or two things. And for Coach Gaines, your man Coleman not having his helmet ready potentially meant he lost his job, because Booby was obviously there. They were going to ride Booby till they got to the state finals and hopefully get past Carter. But, like, would it be something that you'd remember, like, going back in a match, did you go, fuck it, you know what, there was one or two things there. If that had gone right, or if that had gone different, or if that fella hadn't missed that ball, I suppose the snowball effect after it.
or if someone wasn't injured or someone wasn't suspended.
Yeah.
It's all ifs, buts, and maybes, isn't it?
As soon as you lose a game, like, that's all you think about. You hone in on little incidents and single instances in a game, or if only that, or if only I had done this, or if only I had done that, or if that goal had gone in, that would have changed. I think that's the nature of the beast, though, as in, and that's why sports is so great, because most of the time it's unbelievably cruel, but those few times that you get across the line and get that win, or get that performance and that satisfaction from it, I think is huge. Like, if they had won the final there, that would have been Gaines's like triumph of his career, to winning the championship after losing his star player who he built his whole offense around, you know.
The other thing as well on that, I suppose, is that, like, one thing that I'd see the similarity between Friday Night Lights and GA would be the importance of the community, in that, like, a lot of the sports that we'd, and films we'd watch, it would be individuals, or be a fairly small professional group or a small basketball group or something like that. But you could see it for Texas, obviously, it's a community. It's probably as close as you get to GA as any sport in the world, high school football. And I suppose last week with GA getting locked down, and you could see, I suppose, the celebrations that were had in various places. But, like, one of the great things about the GA is the fact that as a volunteer, as an amateur sport, I suppose, like, is there a point in winning something if you can't celebrate it? Like, if you can't go out and celebrate winning the county with your friends, and obviously I'm not saying we're all going out the piss now and we're going to celebrate, we're screwing effort and whatever levels, but, like, isn't that probably one of the most important parts of a club, that when you do have these successes, that it's really a community?
Yeah, it represents the whole area where you're from. Like, people who might never have played the game or even went to a game, they still take satisfaction saying their area won a county title, whatever it is. It's like, it's, as I said, as you said there, like, Texas, the Texas schools there is the closest thing to have to GAA. Like, the intensity of it, the pressure on the managers and teams to perform, but also the joy it brings to the community when they win a match. Like, it lifts spirits completely. And that is what the GAA is. Like, you see it around the country at the moment, like, different teams winning county championships for the first time, whatever it is. And it's just a pity they can't celebrate it the way they should be. But that's the way it is, unfortunately, at the moment. But it's still just a fantastic, fantastic thing, is the GAA. Like,
yeah, so, like, I actually read the book, Friday Night Lights, and the book is probably, it goes a lot more into the town, and it's obviously an oil town, and it's a really bleak, bleak place, like, with savage levels of unemployment, and just, like, socially it's just not in a good position at all. And the football team is what gives it hope to the whole community, you know. And I suppose what we're after seeing over the last number of months is the hope that the senior team, or whatever team of the club it is, if they have even moderate success, what it means to the whole community, you know. And be it BlackRock winning at the weekend, or Crossar Law in Cavan, or Finbar's winning in Intermediate Dublin in Dublin, or whatever it is, like, they're very community based clubs. Or be it Mount Bellew Moylock beating Corrifane and then being bet the following week by Mike Cullen. Like, it's great that it gives people such an identity. And, like, people are giving out about these scenes, but there's literally people who've invested 20 years into getting this moment, and they're not in control of some of the actions they do as a result of it, you know. It's massive, like, and people do need to be able to celebrate and get that identity with their team in place. And
like, it's just like in my home club, we won the County Minor, St. Michael's won the Galway County Minor Championship there last week, first time in 16 years. But, like, just the joy that gives you, like, I'm not living in Galway anymore, but just the joy that happens gives you, it's just fantastic, especially the times it is. And just communities in general, like, just like winning something is just absolutely brilliant. And the spirit in communities, like, throughout the country, like, the affiliation they have to a club, it's just, like, really makes the country, I believe, and it makes a community. and makes it a better place to live.
Yeah, so Colm, you're talking about the celebrations there, and like I know some of the scenes that people will be giving out about some of the scenes, but I think that it's nearly more important. Sport is nearly more important now than ever during this time, particularly the club-based game, because it does give people such a lift, that, and the players for putting the satisfaction that it becomes of winning something that they set out to do, to win at the start of a year. But for those people who lie in the pitches, who cut the grass, who do all the unseen, thankless work around clubs, around the country, all that volunteerism, like for those people, it is so satisfying, and that makes it all worthwhile, if that makes sense. That makes it worthwhile. That makes it a tangible output to the efforts that they put in over the years. And I know it's only a bit of silverware, but the lasting impacts from that, I think, as Monty says, the joy that it brings to people, that's what makes the GAA so great, I think.
Yeah, like, and look, I know the Black Rock and Cork was probably the one, I suppose, the video that went most public. But there was an awful lot of kids actually there. No, look, whether I'd imagine, like, I know that when Black Rock win a county, I was told today that they walk from Parky Cueve or Parky Ring back to their clubhouse. It's about a 20-minute walk. But you could imagine, and days gone by, they're kind of getting applauded as they're going past houses and stuff like that. And, you know, but I suppose with the way that people actually weren't able to go to the match now, and I suppose for kids to kind of see, that's what we aspire to do. That's what my under-8 coach is hoping to get to someday, is that we'll be part of that team. And I suppose, like, with all the other things that the GAA has done, like, it really is, I suppose, the last couple of months has just shown how important it is to the community. And for kids, and as you said, for old people, there's people in their 90s, and I was at a GAA club 2 weeks ago, and there was four fellas well past pension age. But I just know from chatting to one of the lads, I said, they're the brains just outside. And he goes, oh, everything goes through them, you know? And I suppose it just affects the whole community when teams are successful. And I suppose when they're not successful too, but they could really start to see that in the film. And I thought it was unique, especially for American sport, to kind of have that kind of a culture and, I suppose, community feel.
Now, Stephen, used to be an administrator of a big club. And you do an awful lot of community-based activities and stuff. Like, how well does that bring people to the club who might be involved, say the football side of things or hurling side of things? What else can they bring to a club?
It's a tough question, because you're afraid of leaving someone out here, because you could have these really random things going on in the club. And when you're involved in the bigger picture stuff, you're like, that stuff doesn't really matter, you know? Like that, the music session or the whatever on a Thursday, or the walk in club on a Monday, and when you're thinking of how am I going to source some pitches for people to train on, or how are we going to win a senior championship, or how are we going to whatever, you're always thinking of the big things, but it's actually all the little things that make a club or make a community. It's all those little things that feed into the bigger picture that actually make the community, and it's not the same thing to all people. So I played junior E championship hurling over the last 2 years, and lost a championship final and a championship semi-final this year. But some of the most enjoyable hurling I've ever played, because I'm playing with a load of my friends. It's not as much pressure as when I would have played at a higher level in my younger years. Probably the stakes aren't as high. But once you go out on the pitch, you feel like you're playing a senior championship game again in your own head. But at the same time, you're still getting that enjoyment from it. And that's, for me, that's a great release. And it was a brilliant release this summer of all summers. But for other people, it's going down to the club on a Saturday morning and having that cup of coffee, walking around, helping out at the nursery, whatever that may be. And I think, again, that all those small things that add in, and I'd say it's the same for every GAA club and potentially a load of sports clubs or community centres around the country. And I think that's what makes it. That's what makes sport, and in particular the GAA, special in Ireland.
It was one of the things you said there, Stephen, was you're still playing junior E, like, and it does give a unique perspective. No, you're probably starting every game, so that's no problem. But like, if you were a sub the next day and you didn't get a run, you'd be much more conscious of it yourself going out as a coach the following weekend, like, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and it's interesting. So last year, for whatever reason, I think we had a particularly nice summer and we actually got a few games on the main pitch, which was a big bonus last year. And we ended up with a panel of like 30 something. Of course, when you're going well in championship, we got to a championship final. I think there was a free T-shirt or something like that given out. And 36 lads arrived for a championship final. We were playing in O'Toole Park, which have the smallest dressing rooms in the country, probably. And getting togged in the showers, everything. And but lads knew they hadn't a hope of getting on that day, but they were still happy to come out and play, come out for the day that was in it. That was a big deal for them. We lost the game by a point. But to be fair...
Horrible wet day, I remember, Stephen.
It was. It wasn't my finest performance. I'm more of a fine day hurler myself. but I remember afterwards, the crack in the clubhouse afterwards was unreal. Like, and these are lads, some of the lads you'd be very good friends with, but other lads you wouldn't really socialise with that much, as in you'd go up train and then, but the crack that night was unbelievable. And actually a few lads and a couple of one of the coaches decided to get another team together. And then this year there was an extra hurling team in the club. But that gave an outlet now for another 20 to 25 people to actually play hurling all summer. Mm. So from one positive last year in terms of a little bit of positivity and a little bit of a run getting to a final, and all of a sudden that has led to an extra team in the club, which now allows that outlet for another 20, 25 lads. So there's one example of a bit of an impact, and it can even happen at junior lads.
Do you remember what happened that day, Paul? You threw Harry into a light shade.
Up in the club, yeah.
The club.
I was going to expect an exhibition from this two, Stevens and Nelly, and it didn't come to fruition.
Well, he threw the young lad up in the air. He put
the young lad onto my shoulders. And like just whatever, a foot above me head is a big chandelier, and he smashed into the chandelier.
Not a bother on him, I'd say.
Grand. Few of the Eldons fretting about the place, but sure, like he was grand. Like
he'd be fine. It'd be not a bother.
Tough him up.
Exactly it. I suppose they were unlucky in the end. He gave a rousing speech at halftime of the final game against Dallas Carter, but like just look, no. The second last, I think it was the second last play of Wayne, was it Billingsworth or Billingsley or whatever his name was? He bounced off about 15 fellas and got pulled down just on the 1 yard line, and then they had to redo the play because of a foul. But I suppose his speech would probably be one of the things better known about the film. What would be the best speech you ever heard, Stephen, from a manager or a coach?
I'd say the best speech I ever heard was lucky enough to play in an Inter-Firms hurling final a long time ago. We lost that final too, but anyway, we won't go there. But
what's the common denominator between them two finals you're on about, Steve?
Well, me by the looks of things. But the captain before the match was a Saturday, and we were after travelling down to some place in Galway, and
Ballandoreen.
Is that what it was? Yeah.
Ballandoreen,
yeah.
So we were all playing that day, actually, yeah. And anyway, the captain, who should remain nameless, turns around and says, in the warm-up, he says, "Right, lads, I know we've all had a skin full of points last night and we're all in bits, but let's go out there and give it a good old lash, right?" And off we went. I think I even got a slap on the arse as I was going past him on the way out to the pitch, too.
But again, that bonded, like that, man, that Inter-Firms bonded a lot of people together, like this. Like, there's some great nights and great stories that came from that, all because of sport. Like,
sure, the funniest part of the lot was when the crowd from Kilkenny came up thinking they were playing Dublin bus drivers, Dublin coaches, and they went on the piss the night before the match thinking they had a handy one, only to be met with a bunch of actual coaches.
These lads aren't bad for a crowd of bus drivers.
That was the comment, yeah. Yeah, but yeah, it was good times, all right. Good times. Sure. And that, you don't want to name that manager, Stephen, no?
No, he was the captain at the time.
Oh, captain, sorry, captain.
No. He was inspirational, to be fair. You know, that halftime talk, though, that that Gaines goes on in that last game, the final. Yeah. Like, compare that to the halftime talk he gives when they're getting hammered after Booby's getting injured.
Mm-hmm.
and like and compare the reaction that he got out of his players. Like,
yeah.
So like I wouldn't be rating Gaines hugely as a coach for most of the movie, but in those last that last sort of 20 minutes to half an hour, I would have said there was a big change in his style, whether it was deliberate or not, but he was a lot more engaging with his players and talking about being perfect, being able to look your friend in the eye, and that you have the clear eyes, full hearts slogan coming from it and stuff like that, and show them who you are, etc. And then he gets that type of a reaction. You mentioned the run that he goes by 15 players or whatever it is, but he turns to him and says, can you do this? Are you okay to do this? And your man is like, yeah. So he shows he's putting his faith in him and stuff like that. And you think, Jenny, if he had done that earlier in the season, maybe that team would have progressed a little bit more and been a little bit more developed coming into a final.
No, we talked about that previously about, like, so obviously he did, he was a bit more aggressive and a bit more emotional in that talk against Dallas. But you can only do that a certain amount of times. You can't continuously kind of get them to go to that emotional well and in terms of getting a reaction out of them. So that was there. And it was a really good speech, and it got them to connect with each other that, as you said, look at the fellow beside you, you need to do it for him. And like being like when he talked about being perfect, it was just being perfect. There's a lot wrong with being perfect, but it's the actions and the decisions you're making to try and be perfect. That's what's really required, you know?
Yeah, like I think he said, clear eyes with love in your heart, joy in your heart, then you are perfect. And he spoke about friends and stuff like that. But like, was it a case as well that maybe at that stage, like, you know, early in the movie, he felt there was more in them and they weren't producing it, where now he knew we were maxed out. We were 99.9%, just not much more to get out of them. And I suppose, again, going back to the miracle that we talked about last week, and when he dropped the player and he said, thanks for giving me your all. And he, I suppose at that stage, he obviously felt these boys are, they've left everything out there.
Yeah, but at the start of the film, he had Booby.
Yeah.
And like he was the golden ticket. Like he was the main guy who was going to deliver him a state championship. When he got injured, he needed the others to raise their game. As we talked about the emotion there, you can't give that emotional speech all the time. But what I found in that film there was Wayne and Christian made the speech at halftime, the quiet guy. And his words had an effect on the team as well. Like you often hear about when the quiet guy says something, like listen to him. He's not talking all the time, but it's important what he says. And I thought like he showed great leadership there at halftime in that match. And he stood up.
Beast of a man.
Beast of a man. Like a savage fullback.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd wonder then, because you see in the credits at the end then where they go on to win the following year, and I think they were undefeated maybe. You'd wonder though, and I know it's easy to guess or to surmise, is this what happened? But you'd wonder, did he change his style? Did he bring that style forward into the following year? As in, did he go for that more sort of that player coach relationship? Did he concentrate on it more? Maybe the communication was a little less harsh in terms of the style. Because I know what you're saying, mostly the emotional thing, and Paul said it as well, around it being a finite resource, but also roaring and shouting at lads and just screaming at them is, for me anyway, is also a finite resource, because at some stage you just stop listening, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Did they win the year before? Did they win it the year previous?
No, yes.
They didn't. I thought they did.
No, they weren't.
84.
84 and
88 and 89, and then they won the state and national championships, right?
And was that in the book?
No, the book was, again, just
on 88.
Book came out in 90.
Okay.
And I was just having a look at this there last night. They've really dipped since the release of the book, since the release of the film, that they're not, like, they won one more state championship around 1990, 91 or 92.
Okay.
But since, we'll say, Farmer Roy has ended up on them, they haven't been successful. So that element of, we'll say, bringing attention from a media perspective onto what you're doing, does that create added pressure, and then other people want to kind of possibly want to see a fail, or like, you know, like if teams are playing against Man United, they look to raise their game and look to get that little bit more out of them? or against Liverpool or some of the bigger
benchmark teams are, yeah.
Probably not United anymore these days. But just on the media thing, I thought it was crazy the way the 17-year-old players were being interviewed on the side of a training after training. Like that just shows how mad they take the game in that part of Texas. Like they were like, all the media outlets were queuing up to talk to various different players as well as the coach on the sideline after training, not even on game day. Like it's absolutely mad that a sport has such a hold on a region, I suppose, you know.
Remember we went to see an American football team training out in Belfield.
Penn State.
Like, it was scandalous the security they had around it that day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And even if you remember all the amount of staff or whatever, whether they were staff or part of the backroom team, or just the amount of bodies they had just looking after gear, even it was incredible. Like, it's a different setup. It's a different animal altogether.
A multi-million dollar industry, that college football.
It's huge. Yeah, I sure remember at the Vegas game. You could see the setup on the sideline there, Paul. Remember that?
Yeah, you know, I have a hazy recollection of that game. It wasn't that interesting because it was only Division 3.
You have a hazy recollection of the intermediate, or the, not the intermediate, of the Interferms final, is it?
Hey, slander.
Remove that.
go back to the book there for a second, just we bring it up. Did they buy in a lot of their players into that team in 88 from outside?
Oh, do you know, I actually can't remember that.
I haven't read it in 3 or 4 years, so I can't.
No, I could be wrong. I think I remember reading it where they actually got a lot of players in. They spent a lot of money on their team to actually brought in the outsiders, and then eventually the outsiders left and they couldn't afford them anymore. So that might have been the reason they went down.
CBC in Cork City are doing a little bit of that at the moment, aren't they?
I think they're following an example set by inner city club in North Dublin, north side of Dublin.
Explain.
Club teams buying in outside players back in the late 90s, early noughties.
County titles, maybe.
Sorry, mate. The call dropped off me there for a second. What were we saying, Colm?
That's good timing.
Yeah, ideal. Yeah, but sure, Paul, your beloved St. Kieran's would be right for that as well. Like, they'd get players small over the country.
Previously, it's changed. It's changed a little bit since the lack of boarding now.
Yeah, same as St. Jarlett's. No boarding anymore, and they don't get the
St. Flannan, St. Coleman's, you know, teams that dominated Hearties for a long time would have all been boarding schools. Fair and Ferris as well before that. But yeah, like, I think there'd be loose enough transferring going around there in some schools. But sure, look, it's neither here nor there. Any last things to add on Philip or Coach Gaines?
What about like the situation where it's their final ever game at 17 or 18 years of age? That if they don't go on to college football, that's it, done and dusted.
Is there some similarities between that and Leinster Senior Cup in rugby?
Well, there's still the amateur game to fall back on, but the drop off rate is very high, I believe, from players who play schools and then they're gone. Like, I was talking to a coach there of a senior cup team there recently, and he said like they're back in training 4 or 5 times a week. For senior cup already, like it's.
I think the danger of putting a massive emphasis on a one single competition at a young age is massively damaging to the kids, even if they go and win it, because you've basically given them the pinnacle of their career. You've told them this will be the pinnacle of your career. This is the top of the mountain. And they're doing that at 17 or 18. So even if they go and win it, that's it. They've reached the top. Their journey's over. And if they don't win it, they're failures. Okay. And then there's no, how do you build someone back up after that? Like, and I don't think it's just rugby in Ireland. I think
Kennedy Cup at soccer would be very much like that.
Yeah, and I think some it certainly happens in GAA as well, as in
people. The failure.
That's I'm just about to say. People all of a sudden get to under 14 and think failure. Oh, this is a national competition. Let's go and try and win. Like the failure, the whole idea of failure is supposed to be the last sort of fun competition before championship starts at under 15. You know, and it basically is a blitz competition in terms of you play several games in a weekend. So like when people get caught up on that emphasis, we all know teams that were unbelievable at 13s, under 14s, under 15s, who drop off a cliff then as they get older. Because, and I think an awful lot because of that emphasis on one single goal or one single competition has a really, really damaging impact on young players of it.
Like it's built up as in this is the big competition. You get all your gear, your bags, whatever it is, and that's finished. And then what's going on next year? It's like a drop off from like under 14 to under 15.
Where,
like,
where does that come from? Like, because Massey, like, I'm not too sure now with lads in Dublin might have a different opinion, but like, was Fail important to you under 14?
It was a competition, like a blitz, like, and it was grand. And we got beaten, like, I still remember it, we got beaten in a quarter final by a very good Ker Fin team that went on to be the backbone of their All Ireland club success.
They'd be very old players now, Massey.
Not Ciara Fitzgerald and that, and Michael Comer and stuff like that. Like they were, and they won that. They won the Fail All Ireland that year. Like they walked us. So like we do remember it and stuff. But is it like what do you remember your failure for, Paul?
You know, we actually had a like there was the failure, but we also had we'll say a non-competitive failure where we went down to the Rower in the Stig, and I remember me and one of my real good mates. We ended up staying in. Like in a house, and you know what? It was grey crack. And I remember, and I was actually down in the Rower in the Stig this last summer as well. But we ended up, like, there was a pub there, and I can remember running in and out of the pub, chatting to young ones, and drinking crisps and whatever, a can of Coke or a can of Lilt or whatever it was. But it was really memorable, and I really, really enjoyed it. Like,
I noticed football failing now as well, but we only ever had hurling failing when I was growing up. But I remember we won Division 2 hurling failing, and I remember to this day being in Parnell Park and that final whistle going. But for us, it was huge because there was no real hurling teams above us. So it was a massive thing for the club for hurling promotion because we would have been known as a football club. But we also had that non-competitive failure down. I can't remember where. I think we were in Wexford or maybe Wicklow. But the crack we had, we were staying in the house. And now our stay consisted of prank phone calls. And it was ringing people up and say, is your fridge running? And people would automatically say, yeah. And the line back was, well, you better go and catch it then. Hang up and in hysterics for 20 minutes after it, you know.
You know what? In fairness, I can remember as well, like country folk always had great biscuits in their house.
That's some stereotype.
They did.
Yeah, we looked. We always looked after guests, Paul, down in the countryside.
The American tea, is it?
Yeah.
But just look back at that. Like, we all have great memories from Fela and under 14 and under 16.
I don't have any under 4 Fela. I remember we played it, but it wasn't even important.
Okay, but like you have great memories of matches when you're a young guy. Do you know, like,
I remember my first ever match, and we got a bus, and it was about about 8 miles away from where we were, and we got a bus. 50 of us onto a bus, or whatever, 40 of us, and played two matches. There was an under 10, an A team, and a B team essentially, and we got a gun off bottle of Orangina, you know, the small bottles.
Yeah,
after it, and I remember we were all drinking on the bus, and somebody goes, "These are gone off." So I remember the first match. I remember that one. Yeah,
but the trips and the tours, you all remember, like
buses.
You know what I mean.
Bus journey,
the buses,
you always remember.
The bus journey away, getting up early, packing your lunches, whatever it is, probably not sleeping too well the night before, excited about it. They're all memories, like, and that's the stuff you want to create for your players on your team if you're coaching at a juvenile level.
Is Connie Britton the biggest jersey puller of all time?
I just thought, like,
who's Connie Britton?
Connie Britton is Coach Gay. wife.
Yeah. Coach Eric Taylor's wife.
Coach Taylor's wife in the television.
Well, she does. She's in both Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, that's like I was watching Friday Night Lights as a series during the summer, and I think I was on series 4, episode 3, and all of a sudden it was gone. Disappeared to me. So I was disgusted. It was no longer on Amazon. So then when I watched this again the last night, like, she was in it. And then the main booster, what's his name?
Oh, yeah, he's in it. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. He's in both. Well, that was a little bit confusing for me. But yeah, she matured a little bit better.
Oh, she did.
Yeah, in the series.
Anything else, Ted, on Coach Gaines? No.
Yeah, he's no Eric Taylor.
Okay, no Eric Taylor.
Yeah,
okay.
No, you know, I'd be a bigger Eric Taylor fan as well.
Yeah, I would be too. But I thought it was really interesting that last scene where the lads walk out of the stadium, and I don't know what it was. So, like, one of them was talking about, he goes, "I'm going to miss the heat and the lights. Stay low, keep the feet moving." So they were obviously mantras that they had throughout the year, but it was nearly like it was. I don't know whether they had a sense of satisfaction or whether they were relieved that it was over. Because when the quarterback throws the ball away to the kids, big smile on his face. So you wonder what was the overall experience like for them, you know?
Was he passing the baton on to the next generation?
Yeah, I know it's easy. I think this could be just some sort of symbolism or imagery for the movie, but it was a... I can't make my mind up how it finished, how they were feeling, but I thought it was interesting.
Well, usually, like, I'd imagine most players are usually, that give it that much commitment, are usually glad at the end that there's a kind of a contentment that we're done. We're done for the year. Come back next year or whatever. Well, for them, it's probably not too many of them coming back next year, but I'd imagine that it's a sort of, yeah, that's that done now. Onto the next few weeks off now before we do the next thing, you know.
But like when you're finishing with a school team or your last match at school team, that's the last time you're ever going to be in a dressing room, probably with that bunch of guys ever. You know, they're not your club. They're coming from all different areas or whatever it is, different clubs, and you move on. The same, I'm sure, with a county minor panel or under 21 panel or whatever it is.
Right. Okay. What are we giving Coach Keynes out of 5? Mr. Bean, as the guest, you get first punch.
I will give him... am I allowed to give a half mark? Or
yeah, or half. You can go 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, whatever you want.
Hold on a second. Have you not been listening to the other episodes?
I have, but you always argue. Basically, the end of every episode is yourself and O'Brien arguing about scores or quiz results or whatever it may be. So I'm just trying to get a bit of clarification before you jump down my throat, Mossy.
Good man, Bean.
I don't think we had any argument about our scoring of coaches, Paul.
No, Mossy, do you know what? You're always having a go at someone.
Mossy, do you know what? I was just about to say back, do you ever listen to it back?
Rarely.
Yeah, there you go. Right, Bean. Shot, Mossy. Bean's given our score. Anything, any number between 0 and 5.
2.5 out of 5.
Paul.
1.5.
Mossy.
2.
And I'm going 2.5 as well. Paul, any reason why so low?
Because he didn't haul them up on the face in the Adidas boots.
Valid. And Stephen, any reason so mediocre but so high in comparison to the other two?
Take the last 20 minutes out of the movie and he'd be down at a 1 or 1.5, but I thought he showed some good coaching qualities towards the end. He spoke to them a lot more, on a lot more human level. I thought he worked on his relationship. You could see him fight for them on the sideline in terms of arguing with referees and really pushing them on with the halftime talk, etc. So that's why I thought there was hope for him, and I didn't want to give him too negative a mark.
So if there was a Friday Night Lights 1989, he might have improved even further, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Very Always fair. The optimist.
Man. Anything else, Ted, on the show, lads?
The TV series is very, very good. Worth a watch.
Right. I'll have to start that. So the book, Paul, I know you read it. I read it. You recommend it? It's more gritty. Like, the book is a lot more...
Yeah, there's a lot in it. Mm. And the book can wander a little bit because it deals with a lot of social issues as well, you know. Like, it's not an easy read.
No, it's a good read. I think it's a good read, and I think anyone who's interested in it or has watched the film should definitely read it. I'd say it's closer to the film than the TV show, with the type of reality and whatnot of it, but something to check out if you're looking for a read. Okay, we leave it at that. Stephen, Mr. Dr. Stephen Bean, thanks very much for your time.
No problem, lads. Thanks for having me, Colin, Paul, Missy.
We might get you back on next season with another movie, whatever takes your fancy. We'll see what our fans have to say in my season regular contact with them. So,
what was it like for you, Stephen, being on this side of the mics tonight?
Yeah, really enjoyable. It's good to have a conversation and not be asking all the questions all the time. It's great and lovely environment, allowed to express myself and say whatever.
Jesus, you're in an environment where you can't express yourself.
you're like a child that got out for the first time, but I was parents looking over.
No. I couldn't say a bad word about my executive producer, you know.
Go on, tell us about give a quick punch on your own podcast, Stephen.
The coaching bubble. Talk to coaches about all things coaching. That's basically it. So
at Coaching Bubble or at
Coaching? Coaching Bubble on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or SoundCloud.
All regular platforms.
Stephen, if you were to pick 3 episodes of the Coaching Bubble that would be your favourite or you'd recommend people to listen to, what would they be?
Difficult to pick 3. Some of them resonate with me for very different reasons and particular times that I would have been going through. Tommy Dunn's most recently I thought was fantastic. I just loved the way he talked about enjoyment as a measure of success. So measuring training, how well his training session went, measuring the player's enjoyment. And he doesn't mean enjoyment in the sense of did they have great crack and were they laughing and joking. He means did they enjoy it, as in did they get the satisfaction of developing themselves and pushing themselves, and did he as a coach get that satisfaction of driving the lads on and running the session as best he possibly could. And I just love that, because he's at the top of his game dealing with the All-Ireland champions, and he talks about that as a measure. So that really, really jumped out for me in one of the more recent ones. I just hadn't heard anyone talk about that before, you know. Other than that, there's loads of them. It just depends on what topic you're most into. If you're looking for something deep and making you think, Seamus Kelly never fails to get me thinking. And if you're looking to feel good and looking to motivate yourself before you go out to take a training session, Paddy Butler always does the job for me, and his enthusiasm comes true. So I don't like to just pick on 2 or 3, because everyone gives up their time and comes on freely, and I think everyone, so a lot of people get different value from different episodes, and they're just 3 that spring to mind.
Your very first one was my favourite one.
Liam
Morgan.
Yeah, he's class. He's top of the range. He's just a great bloke. He makes you feel great about yourself. Even before that and after that, he's belittling his own involvement in it, and he's talking about how I did a great job asking the questions and making me feel 10 feet tall walking out. But sure, all I did was say hello and off he went. You know, and that's the type of. That's what you want. Like there's some people who are just gifted at making others feel better about themselves, and he'd be one of them.
Excellent.
Thank you, lads.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, Dr. Bean. Thanks, Massey. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favorite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Roy Orbison Tattoo, and we appreciate any likes, retweets, and comments. Next week we will be watching Rocky 2, and we'll have the show available first thing Tuesday morning as always. Thanks, everybody.